argument, United States versus Blaylock. Mr. Ackerman.
Good morning, Your Honor. The court, please. I'm Alan Ackerman, representing Mr. Blaylock, counsel. The questions before the court relate to Rule 11 and its interaction with the most recent U.S. Supreme Court decision, U.S. versus Vaughn. The brief fairly relates the background of the case. October 2001, Mr. Blaylock and two others pled guilty before the district court. It's our position that the district court should have advised Mr. Blaylock at least as to the elements of conspiracy, what it meant in his case, how it is that he may have violated it, and asked him under oath to explain what he did. The district court should have also told Mr. Blaylock that any false statements he gives during the guilty plea colloquy can result in contempt or perjury, and that any truthful statements could not be used against him at a later date. Those are admonitions that were clearly not given, and I believe the government agrees or concedes on that score. The government has included in its appendix, and I might add, after consulting with me, grand jury testimony that Mr. Blaylock gave between the date of his guilty plea, October 01, and his sentencing, March of 02. And in that immunized grand jury testimony, he denies that he conspired with anyone. He denies that he had any weapons. The government, for its part, after that testimony, which comes out about a month before sentencing or 6 weeks before actual sentencing, the government files a request for an upward departure based on obstruction because Mr. Blaylock, according to the government, fibbed to the federal grand jury under immunity. I believe that the government should have gone to the district court and told the district court what happened and asked the district court to vacate the guilty plea. You cannot plead guilty on day one and then testify immunized under oath on day two that I never did it. And it's only the government who is fully aware of both because defense counsel is not present and was not present for the immunized grand jury testimony. So, it strikes me, and this may be somewhat unusual, but you have a 21-year-old defendant, obviously with hindsight sentenced to 40 years. He clearly acknowledges that he sold over a period of 1 month 1.4 grams of crack cocaine, that he acknowledged, but he denies everything else. And then he goes to the grand jury and denies everything else. And then when it comes for sentencing, he tells the district court, prior to the imposition of sentence, that I pled guilty because I was told that I'd get more time if I didn't. I asked the court to look at the whole record as it does in U.S. versus Vaughn. The whole record. And if that record discloses, as we believe it does, that there's plain error here, number one, and that this young man, through his appellate scrivener...
I've lost the thread.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What was he misled about when he...
He was not told that any false statement he may give could result in perjury.
He didn't make false statements at the plea hearing, did he?
Well, when he said yes to the fact that he understood what he was pleading guilty to and that he acknowledged doing it, if you juxtapose that with what was said 2 months later under a grant of immunity before the grand jury, then yes, it becomes important. And in addition to that, he was not...
I don't understand.
I'm sorry.
How could anything that happened later affect the validity of the plea?
Well, if the district court were to learn that the plea should not have been taken because the defendant misunderstood, for example, or did not understand the questions, sparse as they were, but the district court learned later that, wait a second.
He's told that the, or he's not told.
He's not told of two things.
He's not told that he can't lie with impunity.
And he's not told that truthful answers cannot be used against him.
Yeah, but so, and then later he gives a contrary story to a grand jury.
He gave a full contrary.
How does that affect his guilty plea? I don't understand.
Because it undermines the viability of it when you look at an entire record in this case.
What did he say different in the subsequent grand jury hearing that from the guilty plea?
During the guilty plea, he was put under oath, but he was never asked to narrate what he did. The first time he was asked to narrate anything was when he was immunized by the government 2 months later before the grand jury.
What did he say then that he should have said at his plea hearing?
That he, before the grand jury, and my opponent will agree, he denied conspiring with anybody to sell crack cocaine as alleged in the indictment. However, when he was questioned by the district court asked him, well, look, here's what you're charged with. Not do you understand what you're charged with. Here's what you're charged with. You discussed it with your lawyer. Are you guilty? And then there's a pause in the proceedings, and counsel and Mr. Blaylock confer, and then they go back on the record, and the lawyer says, yes, he understands he's pleading guilty, and he's pleading guilty. And that's the nub of it. It's an unusual circumstance. But I ask the court to consider, in all candor, the composite of circumstances here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ackerman.
Thank you.
Mr. Daly?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Your Honor, I too ask the court to consider the totality of the circumstances, and examining the transcript, which is put out in great detail in the government's brief, counsel says that he wasn't fully advised of what he was doing, and I think that's quite to the contrary, that the court in its colloquy at the plea session, it was dealing with three defendants. And in the course of this plea process, not only was the defendant informed of the charge against him, but the court also heard from the prosecutor, the government's attorney, that the facts would be such with respect to conspiracy. I don't think there's a great contention about counts 6, 7, and 8, the possession with intent to distribute. So it seems that it's the conspiracy that is the issue here before the court, or the major issue, and the enhancements then it came at sentencing. Now, with respect to the totality of the circumstances, the age of the defendant here, it was brought out at the beginning of the plea that he was 21 years of age. He had 1 year of college. He certainly understood the English language. His responses were intelligent and timely. They included the break that opponent counsel here has mentioned, where Blaylock consulted with his attorney, and the attorney came back with the words, I believe, and the court then said, I don't want any belief that you may have. I want to know, basically, and I'm paraphrasing now, but I want to know, does he understand? And the defendant then responded, yes, I understand, and the attorney indicated that he had explained what was occurring at the time with respect, and that inferentially now is that at the discussion point in the plea about the conspiracy charge itself. Additionally, the prosecutor presented his factual version, which was intertwined with the first defendant. Two of the defendants were pleading, Blaylock and Lesueur, I think is the other person's name, were pleading without plea agreements. The third, whose name's escaping me at the moment, was pleading with a plea agreement. But there was an intertwining of the factual matters relating to the conspiracy with both Lesueur and Blaylock, and it's inferentially there, and I cited that with the transcript in the brief itself. With respect, Your Honor, to the issue of obstruction, yes, indeed, the defendant testified in front of a grand jury, was granted immunity, and at that point, that's when we have the issue of perjury arising. And clearly, he was admonished and advised of the consequences of perjuring oneself or lying before that grand jury, and he clearly, I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever that there was lying going on in front of that grand jury. And then the application, one of the upward increments in his sentencing was for obstruction of justice, and that indeed dealt with the testimony at the grand jury and not the testimony at the plea itself. And it dealt with a closely related case. This individual named Wade, known as Fat Daddy, was, if you look at it, it's logical to conclude, if you look at the testimony, that's the person that's being inquired about at the grand jury session. And clearly, this was a closely related case. And it's borne out in the transcript itself, whereas between the dates of March 18th and 21st, I think it's the 20th of March, the court is informed, and it's in this record before the court, that indeed Mr. Waite had been indicted and added to the indictment which concerned the activities of Mr. Blaylock. Lastly, the usage of minors is covered, and clearly Judge Gilbert found these to be two witnesses that testified who indicated the usage of minors. He found that indeed they were reliable, and on that basis added another increment. And if the court would have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but that is the government's position, and the brief, I think, states it for Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Daly.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Ackerman, how much time does he have? 2 minutes? Okay, thank you very much to both parties, and court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.